Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does a grizzly bear need to live a long and healthy life, and how has our behavior made these powerful animals so vulnerable? The Natural Resources Conservation Service lists grizzlies as a threatened species, which has suffered greatly with the encroachment of human development into its former roaming grounds. My guest today spent so much time exploring the natural world as a kid in Montana that he was nicknamed the Animal Magnet. Since then, he has devoted his professional life to training and caring for animals in captivity and to ensuring their wild cousins have ample, unpolluted, undisturbed space to roam, hunt, forage, and raise their young. Casey Anderson is a wildlife naturalist and host of Natural Geographic's Expedition Wild. He's in town to speak this evening to the Brinker International Forum at the Winspear Opera House. Casey, welcome to Think.
Glad to be here.
So my introduction did not mention Brutus, who is a very big part of your life, I know, but I figured it would be best if you told us about him.
Well, Brutus was a little bear, I guess now it's going to be 9 years ago, that came into my life when he was about the size of a coffee mug. And I had just started building a grizzly bear sanctuary, and he was our first bear we rescued. He was a bear that was born in captivity, couldn't be released into the wild, basically was going to be euthanized. So we took him in, had a bottle raise him, and when you bottle raise a little bear cub like that, there's a really strong bond that forms. So unlike the other bears at our sanctuary where we have no hands-on contact with them, Brutus loves that. He has emotions to the people that raised him, and that's a big part of his life.
How different is one grizzly bear in terms of temperament from the next?
Just like people. Mm-hmm. Or they're just as individual as people. And it's amazing. You just see, you know, from time to time, whether I'm looking at bears in the wild or the bears at the sanctuary, that it varies greatly. Brutus is the most cool, laid-back bear, has a lot of patience, which usually doesn't come naturally for a grizzly bear. So it's what allows us to work as a team and do a lot to educate the public.
So talk about that, because although you have the sanctuary and you've taken in animals that have nowhere else to go, your lifelong goal is really to make sure that they all live in the wild and they're born in the wild and that's where they stay.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm the ultimate hypocrite in that sense. I truly believe that animals belong in the wild. And unfortunately, we don't live in a world that allows that to happen every time. Mm-hmm. And with Brutus and the other bears of the sanctuary, that they did not have that option. So what I like to do is, you know, for lack of a better term, kill two birds with one stone. Rescue these bears, give them a place to live, let people come in and check them out and see how awesome they are, but then educate them about the wild, their wild cousins and what they can do to coexist peacefully with them.
It seems like, you know, you hear stories of two kinds of campers. You hear the stories of, or hikers, people who sort of are just hoping they'll never see anything wild along the trail and panic if they do. And then people who are so desperate, and I know that there are others, but these are the two you hear about, people who are so desperate to interact that they really get in the way of wildlife. Can you talk about the proper way for us to interact when we're somewhere that animals actually live and we're just visiting?
You know, both of them are in somewhere in the middle is probably the right answer. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the people who are afraid, which I mean, it's good to have a little bit of fear. Then there's the people who are not afraid, and which I think you need to respect the animal too. I find that, you know, people, when they're out there, they need to know they're out there amongst wildlife and take precautions in order to be with them and peacefully. And there's so many things we can do. You know, take bears, for example. We as humans are the adaptive species. We can use tools like bear pepper spray or electric fences that we can put around our camp or bear storage containers. And these tools will allow us to go out into the wild, enjoy ourselves, but be very safe. And then, you know, just common sense. You know, don't go up and try to put your kid on the back of a bear and take a picture. I mean, to me that seems a little far-fetched, but it happens almost every year in Yellowstone National Park. So it's just understanding what these animals are. As cute and fuzzy as they may be, they're still wild animals, and they still have these instincts inside, and you need to respect that.
Now, I know that thanks to conservation efforts, bears in Yellowstone are doing pretty well. Talk about before we moved in all over the place, where bears lived in North America.
Bears actually occupied about, almost every state west of the Mississippi River and all the way down into Mexico. And now in the lower 48 states, they're only occupying 1% of their original range. So essentially, we have basically taken over their habitat. And they're very sensitive. They have pretty big ranges. They don't like to be around people. They don't like to cross highways. So, you know, it doesn't take much to eliminate that range with what we're doing. Yellowstone ecosystem is very unique because it really is an island surrounded by development, highways, and whatnot. So the bears there are kind of stuck on an island. That's one of their greatest risks, genetically speaking.
They sort of interbreed.
Right. The gene pool is limited. So in order for that population to exist in the long term, we're going to have to figure ways of connecting that to northern bear populations, which are not that far away. But it's going to take some compromise on the human side to make it happen.
You mentioned that Brutus was the size of a teacup when you got him. Mama bears kind of have it the worst of both worlds. They're pregnant for a really long time, and then their babies are really, really small and fragile when they're born.
Yeah, no, they don't complain about childbirth very much. I mean, they're little, tiny, tiny little things. And it's interesting, bears actually will mate in the late spring. Mm-hmm. But then what happens is the egg actually becomes fertilized and remains suspended, doesn't implant. So the actual impregnation doesn't happen until late October.
Like when they go into hibernation?
Yeah, and during that time, the mother actually has this physiological response if she's in good shape. At that time, the egg will implant, and that's when the baby will start to develop, or she'll absorb it and wait for the next year. Mm-hmm. So the gestation period is actually very short, and that's why the animal's born so little. And then it's very similar to a kangaroo. It develops a lot like the little Joey kangaroo does in the pouch, and then when it comes out of the den, it's really at the point where most animals are when they're born. Mm-hmm. So it does a lot of development inside the den during hibernation.
Their hibernation, grizzlies, is really interesting because it's like 6 months long, right? But they're not as asleep as some other animals might be.
No, I mean, they're not true hibernators. And scientists go back and forth on this. Now they've dubbed them super hibernators. But they are very conscious. Their heart rate slows down to sometimes 5 beats per minute. Their breath is even less than that. And what they're just finding out now is that their heart actually only works on half the chambers.
Wow.
So the ventricles at the bottom are the only ones pumping, and the atrium at the top are just draining down into the ventricles. So not only is their heart rate really slow, it's only working half. But with that said, if you go into a den in the middle of hibernation, a bear can wake up and be just like it would be in the middle of July.
So you can't assume that hiking in the winter you won't encounter any bears?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I just returned from a trip from Maine where we went looking for black bears, and I literally stuck my foot right down into a black bear's den and didn't even know she was there until I heard one of the little babies go, like, because the cold air that came in. And she was right below me. I didn't even know.
And what do you do? Do you run at that point?
Well, my heart started beating really fast. But
all four chambers.
Exactly. And I stepped back, and she, you know, it's funny, mom stayed in there and kind of kept her babies safe and hooked at me a few times and let me know that she was there. And I had no clue she was there, and I just backed away slowly and just gave her space, and that's all she wanted.
How do biologists study what's going on with their bodies during hibernation? Do they sort of wire them up before they go into it, or what happens there?
Yeah, I mean, it's that interesting thing about, you know, maybe the benefit of captive wildlife situations is that you can get in there and see these animals on a different level. At Washington State University, they have this grizzly bear research center, and they have these relationships very similar to the one I have with Brutus, where they go in and they play with the bears every day and form these friendships. But then part of that is why they're, you know, giving them a honey treat. They're hooking up a EKG to them, and it's part of their day-to-day. And you go there and you go watch and you think, yeah, are these bears enjoying it? And I'm here to tell you they are. It's really fun. I mean, they don't have to worry about their next meal. They go out and exercise and wrestle, and they come back and sleep in these beautiful dens, and then they have these little games that they play, and they get to take all these measurements about their heart. And it's very interesting. You know, there's a lot of things for human heart disease and even osteoporosis that we are learning from these bears that are actually helping us humans.
Because they eat a lot of fat?
They eat a ton of fat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then during that hibernation time, they lose no bone mass, which most people would have, or most animals would, if they had to sit around for 6 months.
Hmm. So I'm curious about Brutus. I know sometimes when people have had chimpanzees in captivity, they're awesome when they're babies and sort of kids, and then they hit adolescence, and the males in particular become very aggressive, as they naturally should, but then people can't have them anymore. Did you worry with Brutus that there would be a point after his sort of childhood when you couldn't have the relationship you do have with him?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a worry, and the answer is Brutus is doing that. He's changing.
Mm-hmm.
He's a grizzly bear. And I think the problem or in the issue is with people who have chimpanzees is that I need to respect that, and I need to understand that and never forget that and respect him for that, for what he is as a grizzly bear.
Like he'll never be your dog.
He'll never be my dog. He'll never be my kid. Mm-hmm. He's a grizzly bear. And, you know, he's an adult now. And adult male grizzly bears are very solitary. And I look at it very similar to my relationship with my father, even though I don't anthropomorphize it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was 18 years old, I didn't need to hang out with Dad anymore.
Yeah.
You know, if I saw Dad, like, on the holidays and that was it, and, you know, we had some good times together, that was fine with me and fine with him. And then our point in Brutus and I's relationship is that it's the same. He doesn't need me as much. He still longs for spending a little bit of time here and there, maybe doing something fun, but other than that, not really. So I don't ever force him to do anything. He does it out of his own will. And I think that's a big key to that. You know, these people with these chimps, they continue to have their chimp do whatever they want them to do. They dress them up in little tutus and they take them driving down and get them Dairy Queen cones. Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous. You know, you're making this animal do something it doesn't want to. And in the end, it can end up hurting somebody.
It's got to be painful for you, though, to sort of have lived through this transition.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I bet my dad, when I went off to college, you know, there was a part of him that was probably disappointed that he didn't have his little kid anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's that part of me, but I can't be selfish about this relationship because my responsibility is to give Brutus the best life possible. He had no other option. He depends on me 100%. And part of that is protecting him. And part of protecting him is not putting him in a situation where he had the opportunity to do something wrong.
So you mentioned earlier there are other bears on the preserve, but they are pretty solitary animals once they are past the stage when they're with their moms as cubs. How do bears interact? And do you have different breeds of bears? Like, do you have grizzlies and black bears and brown bears and all that?
All the bears at the sanctuary are grizzlies, mm-hmm. and they're all very different, and they all have very different relationships with one another. And they interact just like grizzlies would in the wild. It's really interesting to watch because Brutus can go from interacting with me at a one whole different level and then go play with his buddy Jake, and they go full on grizzly wrestling.
So he's like bilingual.
He very much is. Yeah, and he enjoys both sides of it equally. You know, he loves to get the attention from humans, the oohing and aahing. You know, he has that charm and charisma and knows how to solicit a good ooh and ah from the crowd. But then he loves to go get rough and tumble with his bear friends, and he can do both. And he gets to do whatever he really wants to. So he makes those choices himself. And his relationships with people and bears change day to day. And I see one day Jake will be his best bear friend, and then he'll snub Jake, and the next day Sheena will be his best bear friend. And, you know, just ever evolving.
How do you know that Brutus or any of the bears are actually making decisions for themselves? And that I'm sure you have to guard against, like, anthropomorphizing and thinking, well, he loves this. How do you know?
It's really obvious, actually, when you watch them and get to know them, mm-hmm. and look at them every day. There's things I've watched Brutus do that blew my mind. And I'll give you an example. At the sanctuary, we have this giant pond that has this gravity-fed pipe that goes to the waterfall pump. And if the drain gets clogged, the pump turns off to save it from burning up. Mm-hmm. So Brutus has figured out if he goes to the pond, sticks his paws on the drain, it'll turn the waterfall off. Mm-hmm. Well, that's one step. So he'll go, and one day he's in there turning the waterfall off. Well, the waterfall is usually on, so when it goes off, all the other bears at the sanctuary got curious. Oh, look, the waterfall's off. I'm going to go check it out. They went over there to check it out. He picked his paws off the drain, the waterfall landed on his head, and he continues to do this. So he has a sense of humor.
My guest is Casey Anderson, wildlife naturalist and host of National Geographic's Expedition Wild. He's in town to speak this afternoon to the Brinker International Forum at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. That event starts at 8. You can find information at tickets.attpack.org. You can send email to join our conversation to think@kera.org, or you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is wildlife naturalist and National Geographic Expedition Wild host Casey Anderson. He's in town to speak this evening to the Brinker International Forum that takes place at 8 o'clock at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. If you want to be part of the conversation, share a story, ask a question, you can call us right now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Casey, what is like an average day for a grizzly bear when it's not in hibernation? I was stunned by how much they have to eat. I know they're big, but 40,000 moths, did I read that right?
You're right, 40,000 moths. A grizzly bear on average has to eat 20,000 calories a day just to sustain life. So an average day for a wild grizzly bear is literally that, is finding 20,000 calories. And that's a big part of the problem. You know, when you're out there digging up roots or eating grubs and those roots and grubs go away, or looking for pine nuts and then beetles start killing a tree and the pine nuts aren't there anymore, then you start getting strained and start looking for other sources of food. And one of the biggest problems with bears is that they go to humans or humans' garbage for food.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Yellowstone ecosystem, that's an ever-going problem. These bears are getting in trouble. They just basically trying to survive. Get into people's garbage, going into the campgrounds, raiding their food sources, and then they have to be destroyed. Last year alone, I believe about 50 bears of a bear population of about 600 were euthanized because of this conflict.
How do they know they have the right bears?
Usually they put up a trap in the same area, and the bear just returns to the trap that's usually stocked with the same food source.
So what are people supposed to do? I guess you can put your food in something that the bear can't smell. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a bunch of products out there right now that are basically dubbed bear-proof.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put them in there. They don't emit a smell. Or even if they do, the bear cannot get into them and get a food reward and learn that bad habit. So there's, again, a number of products. Another one is a bear electric fences, which I'm a big proponent to because last year, two people were killed in Yellowstone National Park. One of them was in a campground and while they were sleeping. And this is such a very rare thing. But there's this little tiny fence that you can just put up around your camp. And if a bear does come around looking for food and looking at a tent as a food source, this would have saved these people's life. And it's just this very little simple thing that actually runs on batteries. And bears do not like electricity, and they run the other way.
So it basically just gives them a little jolt and scares them off.
Yeah, it's just like a little horse fencer.
Mm-hmm. Talk about what it takes to – now, is Brutus trained, or how would you describe the work that you've done with him?
You know, it's very, very simple training. And it's funny, a lot of it comes from food rewards, but mostly comes from emotional rewards, which is really interesting. You know, you can't be heavy-handed by any means with something like a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
So you have to look for another way of moving a mountain. Mm-hmm. And the way you can is through his desire to make me happy. And it's as simple as good boy and bad boy. And for him, if I say, "You're being a good boy," you can see him get really excited, just like your dog at home. He gets really excited when he's good. And if I look at him, I go, "Brutus, you're being bad." He pouts. He knows he's being bad. And it's amazing just with those simple vocalizations and the bond that we have, what he will and won't do. I mean, he has some behaviors that are trained behaviors, but mostly it's just a relationship. It's a trust between him and I that we have that allows me to do these little things that I utilize for television, for educational programs.
Now, I know that you, as a kid in Montana, were like bringing home stray animals from a very early age. Your parents must have been just really tolerant of this.
It all started because of my parents.
Uh-huh.
The joke to me is that I'm the ultimate hybrid of them. My mother ran a homeless shelter for 25 years, and my dad was a mountain man. And now I give homes to homeless grizzly bears. So, you know, the big reason for who I am is because of them, and they did allow that, you know. I mean, Mom was mad when the rattlesnake got out. We couldn't find it for 3 days and found it in a laundry basket. But, you know, they were the first ones to say yes when the little orphan wolf pup came available and no one wanted to take care of it. And we ended up – that was our house pet for – 8 years.
Huh.
So, yeah, they did definitely nurture my passion, you know, but there was definitely times where they're like, "Okay, are you going to go get a real job? You're going to be a banker? Are you going to, you know, do something real?" And then I'm like, "No." And then, you know, they allowed me to continue to move forward and go to college and study wildlife biology and do what I'm doing now.
Talk about that, because I think a lot of kids would listen and think, this is an awesome job, and not recognize that you need a really strong science background to do this work.
Absolutely. I mean, going to school, learning wildlife biology was a big step in the right direction. And then, you know, during that, the tandem of going out in the field and watching and observing and applying these things I was learning in school directly out there in the wild was such a cool way of connecting the dots and really learning and surging forward. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, open the books and go get your boots muddy.
I read something really interesting on your website that you wrote about learning how to be a better tracker. And you're doing this not to hunt animals, but just to see them. And essentially what you said was that really tracking is just about learning really good ways to observe in nature.
Yeah, tracking is an art, and it may be an art in a funny way. Is that it's a skill that we all have deep down inside, but from the very beginnings of being immersed in culture and society, we start to mask them over and stop looking and listening to these things. But if you go out there and try to exercise these things, they start coming back. And these are very innate little behaviors and little things that you have inside of you. And the more you exercise and the more you calibrate them, it's amazing what you can do. But it is really about this listening and looking, and just it's there if you want to find it. A guy in Botswana, a guy told me, and he used to call me Bear Man. He says, Bear Man, if you want to know where the big animals are, look at the little animals. And it's always true. You know, I've heard, you know, you hear little birds complaining over here and over there, and most of the time you walk by, you don't pay attention. But now that you pay attention, I hear a little bird complaining, I'll go over and I'll watch the little bird, and sometimes I have to watch a little bird for an hour. Then I'll see him, he's looking down on the ground, and I'll go over on the ground, and there's a snake. And, you know, I would have never seen the snake in the tall grass, but the little bird could, and I just listened to the little bird.
Are there things that you do when you're in a habitat that you're not familiar with, that are different from when you're moving around in places you've traveled to many times?
Definitely. You know, I spent a great time in the Okavango Delta in Botswana. And, of course, it's very different than Yellowstone National Park. But there are some basic things that translate. And it takes a little time to get used to the area and a little bit of the behavior changes. But most of all, a lot of it really does translate. And it was interesting. After a couple of weeks, I thought I was getting pretty good at tracking lions.
That seems terrifying to me.
Well, then it's scary. I mean, these are animals that can kill and eat you.
Do you have nothing to fear from the male lions because it's the women who do the hunting? Are you more concerned when you see a female?
I think they're pretty much even across the board. I mean, they're both opportunists, and if you put yourself in the wrong situation at the wrong time and they're hungry, they could easily kill and eat you. But like most animals, they would rather not.
Yeah.
I mean, 99% of the time, they're actually more fearful of you than you are of them.
What's your feeling about, you know, there are these companies now that do commercial safaris for people, not to kill animals, but they're out there. And there are some, like in parts of India and other places, where, you know, there's all these questions about how the animals contribute to the local economy. And is that good or bad? Do you have a sense of you know, how we should think about these things?
I do. Yeah. You know, I felt kind of mixed about it. And Botswana is a great example. Here's this country that actually is embraced this tourism, and in turn it is one of the countries in Africa that still remains wild and awesome. I mean, they have these big open areas and these big parks that really are truly wild. They're not fenced in kind of canned safaris, and the reason why they get to remain to be that way is because there is this monetary flow coming in from tourism and stuff. And if that's the price we need to pay to keep what we have, then I think it's worth it.
Yeah, as opposed to plowing under the same land to grow crops or something.
Absolutely, and that's, you know, that's what's happening in most other African countries.
Mm-hmm. I know that you and Brutus, I don't know if you still do, but you've traveled together in the past?
Yeah, we do travel once in a while.
How do you do that? I mean, you can't stay in a hotel, right? What do you do?
No. Brutus actually has his own custom grizzly, like grizzly-fied trailer, I call it. It looks very like a cargo trailer, actually, on the outside, but on the inside, it's you know, structurally sound. He has air conditioning. He actually likes to listen to the radio when he's on the road.
So this is like a Cribs kind of Pimp My Ride kind of grizzly trailer.
Exactly. And it's funny, you know, he's ridden in this thing since he's a little cub, so he's very comfortable. And the best way I can describe it, it's like his dog kennel.
Mm-hmm.
And when he sees it, he reacts to it like if you're going to take your dog for a walk in the park.
Oh, sure.
And you go, you grab the leash off the wall, and as soon as he sees you reach for the leash, they just start jumping around. When he sees his Pimp My Ride grizzly trailer pull up. He gets so excited because he knows he's going to go somewhere, see new things, have different adventure, and he loves it.
Do you have to like take food with you so that you're sure that his diet is consistent along the way?
We do. Yeah, and, you know, he's got a pretty unique diet. You know, he's an omnivore, and 80% of his diet is fruits and vegetables, apples, oranges, lettuce, carrots, and he loves avocados. And then he does eat some meat, salmon, chicken, beef. Sometimes wild game from Montana. So we like to keep it the same. So we'll stock up really good and take it on the road.
Will he hunt for his own food and forage for his own food when he's at the preserve? Or is he so accustomed to having meals delivered that he's like, no, I'm not going to do that?
Exactly. Yeah, he's spoiled. Yeah, working for food hasn't been in his MO since he was a little tiny cub. So he doesn't really try. In fact, one of the episodes of Expedition Wild, I try to teach him to fish like the bears do in Alaska. And I tried every tactic. And in the end, he ended up being afraid of the fish. You know, these are the same things he's eating, but they needed to be filleted and, you know, laid out very nice for him. But to learn how to fish and actually kill something is actually a taught behavior.
Oh, so is that one of the things the cubs are learning from their mothers when they're...
Yeah, in fact, I went to Alaska and just literally sat there and observed females teaching their cubs how to hunt.
How do they do it?
So many different ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all have their own tactic, which is really cool. You know, some of them will pounce on the fish. They'll like watch them chase them and pounce on them. Some will wait for the fish to come to them. And like you've seen that classic shot where the fish is jumping in the waterfall and they snatch it out of the air. Some, what I call the hot tubbers, will sit in these deep holes. And they just kind of sit around and they feel with their feet and their paws and they'll just grab them that way. So they all have their own different tactics. But those are passed down generation to generation. And they take their cubs in and teach them these skills. And I went and watched, learned all the skills, went back to Montana and tried to replicate each of these situations with Brutus. And he just couldn't do it.
Did he just watch you like, oh, there's Casey trying to catch a fish?
Absolutely. You know, and that just showed that I can't replicate what a mother bear can, one. And then how important it is to allow these cubs to have this time with their mother to learn these things in order for them to survive.
When you talk about they all have different ways and they pass them on, that sounds like culture to me.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And in fact, it's an evolutionary thing happening out there in Alaska. You know, like now they build these fish ladders that go up from there's like waterfalls where the fish can't go very easily. So they build these little ladders so the fish can go easily back to their spawning grounds so they can sustain the salmon population, ultimately, usually for fisheries. But these bears, as these fish ladders are going in, they too are adapting some of their techniques to the fish ladder. I mean, there was plenty of bears that were fish ladder bears that recognize this funneling of fish, would crawl right into the fish ladder, teach their cubs, hey, crawl into this fish ladder. It's where all the fish are going to go. So, I mean, they're learning and changing and as culture changes.
What happens after that 2 years when they're finished being cubs and they go off on their own?
It's the scary next few years. I've actually witnessed once a female getting rid of her cubs, and it was one of the scariest, most heart-wrenching things I've ever watched because these cubs don't want to go.
Yeah.
And mom is basically fed up. She can't, you know, sustain the additional 40,000 calories a day. And she just has to leave. And she beats them up pretty good. And it's terrifying. The babies are screaming and screaming and screaming. And the next couple of years, they're really important years for them because they have to take what they've learned and apply it and survive. And it's one of the highest years of mortality for all bears. Like 50% of bears don't make it through that year.
Are there signs other than their age that this is coming? Like, does the mother bear try to, you know, sort of push them away for weeks or months before the final separation?
You see a lot of bickering at food sites. Like I've witnessed a bear on an elk calf kill with two cubs that were pretty good size. And when they're there, you know, eating, you see a lot of little fights here happening here and there. Mom's treating them a little bit more like adults. And then one day she just takes off running and they chase her and chase her. When they catch up, she beats them up and she runs and runs. And it's really sad. I watched it and it's like I'm rooting for the cubs to catch up, but I knew that that was all part of the game and the plan.
I was surprised to read how fast they can run.
As fast as a racehorse.
Not for very long though, right?
Not very long, but I've seen them sustain that speed for over a half of a mile, which is quite a distance. And yeah, they might look roly-poly and slow. But when they want to, they can run as fast as a cat.
What would make them run? They don't run after their prey, do they?
Sometimes, but primarily just to get away. I mean, grizzly bears are terrified of people. When I go into Yellowstone, I take every precaution for them to not know I'm there. Because when you see them and they see you or smell you, they bolt like lightning. And you'd hate for them to waste that energy that they spent the whole week trying to build. And that's one reason why they run. And then the other reason is to hunt things. And they don't hunt very often, but they will. In Yellowstone, they'll hunt elk calves during the calving time. And the elk calves can run pretty quickly at a pretty young age. And they will chase them down. And it's amazing. It's like watching what you think you would see in the Serengeti, like a lion chasing down a zebra or something. It's that athletic and that high energy, high paced. And these bears can really move.
Now, I know that you've done some documentary filmmaking. Are you ever behind the camera, or are you just sort of directing the action or there to observe and tell your crew what to do?
A little bit of everything. You know, I run the camera sometimes. You know, I'm in front of the camera a lot. I'm tracking, writing, producing in every aspect. I'm pretty much hands-on on everything.
So it's not like you and 15 people out there?
No. In fact, I think we like to dub ourselves as kind of like the special forces of wildlife filmmaking, because we usually have 100-pound backpacks full of every bit of gear we can carry.
Wow.
There's usually me and two other guys maximum. But you have to keep it light and fast and, you know, just in order to get close to these wild animals, in order to witness these wild behaviors happening without any indication there's humans around. I mean, as soon as they know you're there, they're not doing these wild, cool behaviors anymore. So it's tough.
Do you set up remote cameras ever?
We do. We're really getting into remote cameras now. There's a lot of good new technology. And I just finished a mountain lion film. And they're tough to see, period. I've seen maybe a handful, like five in the wild ever before this year. And now this year, I think I saw an additional seven. But then on my remote cameras, I saw almost 30.
Wow.
And caught all this great behavior, some behavior that's for the first time ever that'll be coming out in one of my new episodes.
My guest this hour is National Geographic's Expedition Wild host and wildlife naturalist Casey Anderson. He's speaking this evening at 8 at the Brinker International Forum that takes place at the Winspear Opera House. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Casey Anderson. He's a wildlife naturalist and host of National Geographic's Expedition Wild. He'll be speaking this evening at 8 to the Brinker International Forum at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So when you're planning for a season of Expedition Wild, I mean, obviously you're planning the locations you're going to go to, but you can't know what's going to happen, right? So how do you sort of go into each filming episode and like, what do you know and what do you not know?
You know, you're right. There's no script. Mm-hmm. And it's scary sometimes, especially if it's an animal that you don't know a lot about. But what I find from our audience is that they want just to come along on this expedition, regardless if you see animals or not. Mm-hmm. You know, the audiences these days want genuine events and genuine things to happen and unfold. And there's been times that we've gone out and hardly found anything, and they've been some of our best shows because it actually paints a very accurate picture of what's happening out there.
That's really interesting. Yeah, so don't expect it to be all, you know, I was going to say Crocodile Hunter, but that's now a bad example. But it's not always dramatic.
No, and sometimes the lack of drama is drama in itself, and people really enjoy that because it's this authentic feeling of coming along on this expedition. And that's really how we produce the show. We really want people to feel like they're with us out there in the field. And every day, you know, that's our responsibility.
Do you feel an obligation to document also the places where the environment has degraded?
Absolutely. I mean, I do find, you know, there's some very beautiful wildlife documentaries out there right now. But I think one thing is that they're kind of painting an inaccurate picture of what's actually happening out there. You know, then I do hear people from time to time is like, hey, why should we care? Why should we do anything? Look how beautiful it is. Mm-hmm. You know, so it is important to paint both sides of the story or the what actually is happening out there so people really know what's going on.
We have an email here from Michelle who writes, my son loves science and wants to go camping, but I don't know anything about camping. Where should we start?
Well, I tell you, I've been all over the world, and the most beautiful place in the world is right here in our backyard in Yellowstone National Park. Mm-hmm. It's spectacular. And if you want to go camping and be in a place that's as wild as it's been for thousands of years, but be able to be safe and take these tools that we were talking about, you know, the electric fence, the bear spray, so you know you're safe, and go out there and just relax and enjoy and take in, you know, this beautiful, wild place. We've got it right here.
Do you have to apply in the same way that I know to camp in the Grand Canyon, you have to, you know, months ahead of time sort of make your plans? Is it the same thing at Yellowstone?
Yellowstone's a little more liberal that way. They do have campgrounds that you just can kind of first come, first serve basis. And then there are backcountry campsites that you can go to that they recommend that you sign in for just so they know that you're out there and you're okay.
What's the right combination? And I know you're definitely an expert in this, but for the average person, the balance between having enough stuff to make you comfortable and safe and really just bogging yourself down, and you might as well have a satellite dish up next to the tent.
I mean, everybody, you know, has their own comfort level. Mm-hmm. And I think do whatever you really want to. You know, for me, I'd like to take as little as I can, and I like to feel as close to the land as possible. But if you want to watch satellite TV after you've spent a good day fishing along the stream, that's okay, as long as it gets you out there and gets you experiencing these wonderful things that we have to experience.
Okay, so I have to ask you a little bit, if you don't mind me being personal, about your married life, because your wife is an actress. You've also done some acting in addition to the documentary work you've done. It would seem like you have this dual life between being this really glamorous couple and being really outdoorsy. But I mean, were you already dating when a young bear cub came into your life, or how did that all play out?
No, it was actually kind of the opposite. Brutus is responsible for the hookup. You know, and you even kind of considered me an actor is kind of hilarious, but I kind of acted as the right answer. Brutus was invited to go on a movie set where he was going to play a bear coming into a campground.
He's got a limited range, I guess. Right?
Yeah,
he can
right,
pretty
yeah.
much play bears. And
yeah, bears and bears, yeah. And so during that movie set, Missy, my wife, was the lead actress on that film. And that's where we met each other. And then about a year later, we started dating. But so she was well aware of the bear in my life. You know, and I never thought as a Montana kid in the outdoors that I'd ever marry an actress. But I took her on some test dates. We went on some 40 below snowshoeing hikes through Yellowstone, and she endured it all. And I thought, well, if she can endure that, I better marry this one.
So it was like a toughness litmus test, basically.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, and she did the same to me. She took me to, you know, a red carpet event, and there I was in a, you know, a tux with my beanie on.
So, yeah, how do you guys live in Montana most of the time?
That's Montana's home, mm-hmm. Yep. And Missy does have a home in L.A. that she stays at when she's working sometimes.
Mm-hmm. When you started doing film work with animals, was it strange to sort of enter that world? Or because you entered from the sort of more naturalistic side, was it easier to kind of learn how people communicate about entertainment as opposed to documentary work?
Yeah, you know, I really don't, you know, like to do the entertainment bear stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not, I'm not a bear trainer. In fact, right. I hate being called a bear trainer. But it's, Brutus likes it. And I'll look at what the story is and what the job is. And if I see that Brutus is going to come and be able to go on there and enjoy the stimulus and the oohing and aahing we were talking about and being in the spotlight, which I know he really loves. Mm-hmm. Then I can go ahead and do it. And it's just part of his extracurricular activities. But everybody knows when I go on set and I tell the producers and everything that, hey, Brutus doesn't want to do it, we're not doing it, period. You know. And there's been days that Brutus has literally not wanted to do it, and we've had to scrap the whole day. And I know that made some people mad, but that was the rules.
Are there laws to protect animals working in feature films in the same way that there are to protect children?
There are laws. The Humane Society has a kind of a a unit that deals with that, with motion picture stuff. But, you know, even the laws are a little bit too lenient, I think, mm-hmm. you know. And, I mean, I have my own set of laws that I feel that are even more animal-friendly. But they are looking out for animals out there, and that's good.
Do you find that people that you work with assume that because this is a bear that has been trained to a certain extent that, like, he's totally tame and you can do whatever you want with him?
That people do think that. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a bad thing. You know, tame is the word I hear a lot, and he's hardly tame. He is trained, and he's just patient enough to allow us to be in his life, essentially. But and sometimes the opposite is really funny is, you know, I'll go on set, and before the bear comes on set, I'll give this briefing. I'll say, hey, no one touch Brutus, no one kiss Brutus, no one hug Brutus, no one, you know, talk to him. And half the people there, they weren't going to even show up that day for work because they were so terrified that there was going to be a grizzly bear on set. Mm-hmm. And they all look at me like, what are you, nuts? We would never do that. Well, Brutus walks on set. He does his Brutus charisma charm thing, walks around. And these very same people who are looking at me like I was nuts are going, can I kiss him? Can I touch him? So he's breaking these barriers mm-hmm. just in his personality, which I watch and I actually find is a gift. And it really makes it possible to do the things we're doing.
Now, I know that you guys, you and Brutus have wrestled and sort of played, and you've been hurt before.
Yeah, the wrestling and playing days are coming to an end because mm-hmm. he's just so big.
Yeah.
I mean, he never has hurt me in a violent manner, just accidentally rolling over on me.
Was he like 500 pounds?
He's 800 pounds
800
now.
800 pounds.
Yeah, and when you get 800 pounds like accidentally rolling over under your rib cage, you'll get a rib that'll crack here and there mm-hmm. or a spleen that'll get bruised, and those have happened. So I don't do it anymore.
Is it hard to get back on the horse, even in terms of interacting with him in a regular way after that happens?
No, I mean, they happened in such a way that was so obviously accidental mm-hmm. that I never had any sense of fear, I guess. It was just, you just become more aware where you're at when you're around a big giant bear.
Are you, like, just contracted with Nat Geo, or are you on staff with them?
No, my production company is basically commissioned to do shows for them.
Okay, I was wondering who pays for your insurance.
I have this nice title that they call uninsurable.
Really? So nobody will take you for health insurance or for life insurance?
Well, they'll take me for about a week, and then yeah. they find out what I'm doing, and they tell me no more.
So you just have to be extra careful, I guess.
I do.
Obamacare would help you?
Maybe.
President Obama's – I get in trouble for calling it Obamacare, which is sort of a shorthand term. But talk about where you plan to go with the preserve. Like, will you continue taking bears, and how many can you take in the amount of land that you have?
Yeah, right now the sanctuary is pretty much maxed out, and we only have 5 grizzly bears. What happens often is people just continue to rescue to the point where they end up being a rescue situation themselves. We made that conscious decision in the beginning to make sure we were going to go above a certain amount. Mm-hmm. You know, if another bear comes along and we have a space for it, we'll definitely try to do what we can. But in the end, what we're really trying to do is just educate people so that there's not these bears out there existing anymore. No more bears to be rescued. And eventually, you know, after Brutus is gone and all the other bears are gone, I hope our place goes away. Hope we don't need it anymore. And that's the inevitably is what the goal is.
Do you have your bears on, like, birth control?
They are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything's spayed and neutered at our place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, captive breeding of bears is a dead-end street. I mean, once they're born in captivity, they can't be released into the wild, and it's just this never-ending.
Like, immediately, they're just unsuitable for living in the wild.
Yeah, it's really based on some of those things we were discussing about mother not teaching them how to survive out there in the mm-hmm. wild, these essential survival tools.
And do you have a veterinarian on staff up there? Is there someone? It seems like wildlife veterinary medicine is so different from domesticated animals.
I have a great vet. He's not on staff, but he's just right there around the corner, and he loves his bears. He knows his bears. And, you know, there's only so much he can do.
Yeah.
So I end up being the vet's assistant quite a bit.
Do you have to tranquilize them before you do anything?
Sometimes. You know, a lot of the training things that we do with the bears are based on these veterinary needs. So, you know, if we have to check their teeth or give them a shot, we can do all of that without having to tranquilize them. Just do a little behavior, give them a little treat. They don't even know they're getting their vaccination, and everybody's happy.
What do you think about the state of U.S. conservation laws with regard to grizzly bears in particular?
It's a tipping point right now. You know, they're considering taking the grizzly bear off the endangered species list, which sounds like they've just done with the gray wolf. Mm-hmm. You know, it all boils down to compromise, I'm starting to see. You know, if people don't want these animals, we won't have them. And there's a great part of our country that really doesn't want them anymore. And it's so, and a big reason why they don't want them is because they're getting a lot of things taken away from them. You know, a lot of their ways that they're making a living, mm-hmm. or, you know, these heritage hunting type things. Or so I find that if we're going to have these animals, there's kind of this middle ground that we need to come to, you know. For instance, right now with the wolves in Yellowstone, they're taking them off the endangered species list, and they're starting a hunting season. One side says no hunting. The other side says, let's kill them all. Mm-hmm. I feel like if, you know, we have a very sustainable quota in the hunting season that allows these people to make a living off hunting guides and stuff like that, and at the same time the other side allowed these wolves to be around, then somehow it's going to balance itself out and it's going to be okay. But what happens when it's so polarized, it seems like no one's winning, and the animals are suffering every time.
I didn't know that people hunted wolves.
Well, it's just going to start again this fall.
And do they eat the meat at least, or do they just, is it a trophy?
It's more of a trophy hunting thing, and in the end it ends up being a way for a hunting guide or hunting outfitter to just, you know, make a little bit more money.
Mm-hmm. So what do you suggest people do who do want these animals around? I mean, are there organizations we can donate to, or are there just ways of sort of living our daily lives?
You know, it's I always say the greatest piece of habitat left for these animals is right here in our human heart. And, you know, there's a lot we can do. You know, and there's a lot of organizations out there. I could name a bunch that are doing wonderful things. Vital Ground Foundation's very good. They're buying up a lot of private land that's in critical grizzly bear habitat and allotting them to the grizzly bears. Because in the end, urban sprawl, as the, you know, the human population goes up, there's just no more room for these animals anymore, you know, and people are moving out there into their backyards. So keeping what we have out there, you know, giving them a place to live, trying to coexist with them, do everything we can to do that, you know, learn, prepare yourself, go out there. And I think that we have a chance. We just got to educate ourselves.
Have you always got a list of places that you would love to explore for your next program or simply for your own personal education?
Yeah, I mean, I have a bunch of dream jobs mm-hmm. that I would love to do. Right now, one I keep trying to do that they're not allowing me is there's actually a grizzly bear, a brown bear population in Pakistan.
Wow.
Yeah, high in the Karakoram region. And it's no one knows, you know, about grizzly bears in Pakistan. And I think it'd just be there's a group of people up there who are fighting for the grizzly bears on the other side of the world, and they have all the same passions that I do, you know, but they're from the other side of the world and a lot of political differences and whatnot. But, you know, we all have the same love and we all care about these same animals, and it all boils down to habitat and conservation.
If you were to write a book, it sounds like exactly the kind of thing we talk about on this show. So if it happens, come back and see us.
I will.
Casey Anderson is a wildlife naturalist and host of National Geographic's Expedition Wild. He'll speak tonight at 8 to the Brinker International Forum at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. Casey, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.